The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
When the Facts Change is brought to you by the Spinoff Podcast Network, in partnership with KiwiBank, the bank for Kiwi looking to get ahead in business and in life, a bank that delivers expertise and banking know-how, smart advice for business owners wanting to invest, grow their business, or diversify, a bank that adapts with technology through the lens of its people and customers. It is a bank with heart that is driven by its purpose, Kiwi making Kiwi better off. So what is sociopathic behaviour? I googled it, and the best description I could find was from WebMD that listed the seven symptoms of a sociopath. Someone who has, one, a lack of empathy for others. Two, impulsive behaviour. Three, attempting to control others with threats or aggression. Four, using intelligence, charm or charisma to manipulate others. Five, not learning from mistakes or punishment. Six, lying for personal gain. And seven, showing a tendency towards physical violence and fights. That sounds right. That's sociopathic behaviour. I like to look in When the Facts Change at the behaviour of our political economy. Why is it we collectively make decisions, pass laws, have policies, decide to spend money here, decide to tax something there, decide things that affect us all over a long period? How is it we make those decisions? Be quite nice to make good ones. And this year we are making a doozy of a decision, a sociopathic decision, one that hurts people in a really clear, large, and vicious way, from decisions that are being made deliberately in public by people we elected. I'm referring here, of course, to the repeal of the smoke-free rules by the new government. One of the first things it did, a real surprise for a lot of people who certainly didn't see it in the manifestos of any of the major parties, it was actually buried and not talked about in the New Zealand First manifesto and was briefly mentioned by ACT. However, certainly it wasn't in the National Party's manifesto, and when it cropped up in the coalition negotiations and then the final coalition deals, I don't think anyone could quite believe not just the cheek of it, but the sociopathy of it. This was a government choosing to repeal a bunch of laws that will mean thousands of people get to live longer or live at all. Repealing laws that would mean thousands of people actually stay alive, that they earn money, they have fun, they have kids, they have families, they are part of our community, they're us. These laws are designed, once repealed by the current government, to bring in more than $1 billion extra each year. Why? It's pretty clear. So that money can be used to pay for tax cuts for people largely who already have plenty of money and certainly plenty of assets. Assets, by the way, which aren't being taxed, or at least the capital income from them aren't being taxed. This, for me, was the most shocking piece of political economy that I've seen in my time covering politics in Aotearoa. It shocked a lot of voters. In fact, more than half of the National Party, New Zealand First and ACT voters, upon hearing about it, didn't want the new government to do it. And so I think a lot of people were surprised that the new government carried it through, but they did. But without doing the sort of analysis they should have. In this week's When the Facts Change, I speak to Professor Nick Wilson, who is a doctor who specialises in looking at the public health impacts of policy interventions, and with a group of other academics, published a paper in the British Medical Journal last year looking at the benefits and the costs of the various changes to smoke-free rules that were passed by the Labour government in 2022, which was part of Aotearoa's quite long and distinguished history in fighting to reduce smoking rates. Ironically, a policy to get to a smoke-free situation by 2025, which was introduced by National in partnership with Te Pāti Māori when they were in coalition. This time around, though, in these coalition negotiations, National and New Zealand First and ACT decided it would be better to keep the excise revenues by having more people smoking for longer. And this was something that was unstated. Ensure that more people die before they collect New Zealand superannuation. Because it turns out that's a big part of the economic calculations. In this research that Nick Wilson and his colleagues did, they found that the overall benefits of keeping these smoke-free changes would be in the tens of billions of dollars by 2050. Not only because more people would live longer, they would pay more tax, they would buy more things, they would have an extra 500,000 quality-adjusted life years. Now, there is a cost to the government, less excise revenue, and of course, this slightly painful business of having more people live longer and having to pay them New Zealand superannuation. But the net effects, if you're doing a cost-benefit analysis, which you should be if you're a government that says it's all about the economic effects of its policies, the cost-benefit analysis says that everyone in this country would be better off by billions of dollars in the coming years. And for many, many people who aren't even born yet or are babies right now, they would be better off. This week on When the Facts Change, we do an economic analysis of a sociopathic decision, one that has made the government unpopular and was passed through Parliament and will mean that a certain number of people will die to make sure that tax cuts are paid. That's this week on When the Facts Change with Professor Nick Wilson. Tēnā koe, and welcome into When the Facts Change to Professor Nick Wilson from the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago. Great to see you, Nick.
Kia ora.
Now, I'm always curious about decisions made by governments that have some sort of economic but also social effect, and trying to find ways to make these decisions which are consistent and really look into the long-term effects of policies. It's always amazing to me that policies are made without, you know, a really good long-term look, and particularly public health ones where, you know, there's lots of different things that happen after you've done the intervention. You've looked, along with some colleagues, at the end of last year at the changes to the smoke-free rules that the previous government passed through Parliament at the end of 2022. Could you tell us about this paper that you and some colleagues produced and that was republished in the British Medical Journal titled Economic Effects for Citizens and the Government of a Country-Level Tobacco Endgame Strategy, A Modelling Study. So could you tell us about the background to this piece of research and what you did and what you found?
Sure. Well, this work followed on from a long period in which we'd done modelling on different tobacco control interventions, really over a 10-year period. And as the government's thinking started to focus on three particular strategies, taking the nicotine out of tobacco, reducing the number of retail outlets and the smoke-free generation idea, we specifically modelled the impacts of those on the health of New Zealanders. And that produced some very large gains in health over a long period of time. And we estimated over 500,000 quality adjusted life years. And we also looked at the life expectancy benefits of that and also the equity benefits, because there were big gains for Maori health as well. And after that work was completed, we gave the results to the government, and that, I think, helped firm up their thinking about these particular interventions. And they actually passed a law which dealt with those three interventions in 2022. And after that, we focused a bit more on the economic aspects, and we looked at nearly every aspect we could think of from a citizen perspective and also a government revenue perspective. And on the citizen perspective side, we found very large income gains would occur for the New Zealand population, largely due to the reduction in having to buy tobacco to because people are addicted to tobacco. But also we had been doing studies on the impact of different diseases on people's income, because New Zealand has very good data on where you can link health information with even tax information. So we were able to do studies on the diseases associated with tobacco and their impact on productivity. So putting all that together, we found actually up to 2050, there would be $46 billion of extra income in the pockets of New Zealand citizens if these interventions were rolled out. But on the other side of the ledger is what would happen to government revenue. And actually, we did find that from the government perspective, because of their reduction in tobacco tax and increased superannuation payments and so on, the government would have a shortfall, less than half of that $46 billion. So we estimated $17 billion extra, well, shortfall for the government. But then we also did other analyses to look at how that shortfall could be reduced. And we found that because the tobacco control interventions would increase people's health and life expectancy, if you adjusted the retirement age just slightly by an extra 10 months, so up to 65.8 years is the start of retirement age, you'd nearly wipe out all that shortfall. So, and that would be for people at just as healthy as they were at the current 65-year setting. So the interesting thing was that the government's revenue issue could largely be dealt with by very small adjustments in the retirement age for benefits. And that it would be really perverse if the government didn't follow this type of tobacco control, because the benefits for the population are so large, and the issues of government revenue can be quite easily dealt with. So we were really very surprised that the new government didn't pick up on this new information and follow the previous government's legal processes.
I'm fascinated in how you come up with the numbers here, turning a health change into some, you know, dollars and cents, if you like. And I was keen to drill down through some of these concepts and understand, for example, to start with, how you can model a quality-adjusted life year from a change in the number of people smoking, how much they're smoking. Just to sort of understand how important smoking is in our lifespan and how much quality per year we have in that lifespan. Could you talk us through the effects of the physical effects of smoking and how it affects our quality adjusted life years?
Sure. Well, smoking is one of the most well understood health hazards. You know, really since the 1960s, And estimates are over 100,000 studies have been done on smoking-related health impacts. So we know that there's actually about 40 different diseases associated with smoking. And so we can, in the models that we've been using, we've been able to see if for a certain reduction in smoking, for example, if we know very well as the tax goes up, there's a certain percentage decline in smoking. So we can see what would happen with that percentage reduction in smoking, link it through to the various diseases that are linked to smoking at different levels of relationship. So, for example, there's many cancers, particularly lung cancer. They go down as the smoking rate and smoking level goes down, but also heart disease and various lung diseases, diabetes, and so on. And these relationships are now extremely well established. So you can see when you adjust for other factors causing cancer and so on, you can pretty well have an accurate assessment of the impact that would have. And for each disease, there's been many studies that put a weighting on the reduction in quality of life associated with that disease. And that can go from the extreme impact of disability associated with having bad heart disease or virtually being unable to breathe with emphysema, down to very minor conditions. Even people have assessed what it's like to have a brief headache or a sore toe and so on. So we can put a quality weight on all these different diseases. And we can also see the impact of a fatal disease on life expectancy. So if you lose 10 years of life from lung cancer, that is equivalent to 10 quality adjusted life years. But if you also live for 20 years with a disease that's halving your quality of life, such as severe emphysema, that is also equivalent to the loss of 10 quality adjusted life years. So we can total up the impact of smoking changes on all these different diseases and taking into account the effectiveness of the intervention, which is often very well known for things like tobacco tax, less well known for things like reducing the number of retailers or taking nicotine out of tobacco. But we were able to make some best estimates and build an uncertainty into our models. Then we can run these models for as long as the current population is alive. So running the model for modelling basically every New Zealand citizen until they die and comparing that with business as usual, we can estimate the gains in the health of the population running it over that period. And some of those gains don't eventuate for decades. For example, if you prevent a 15-year-old taking up smoking, you may be preventing a lung cancer in 30 or 40 years' time. But for established smokers who, if they quit smoking and it delays their heart attack by 5 years, you can start to see those benefits in the modelling in a very short period of time.
When the Facts Change is brought to you in partnership with KiwiBank to help you understand the issues affecting the economy. And that's what their team of experts is here to do too. Here's KiwiBank's chief economist, Jared Kerr, on what's happening with inflation in 2024.
Globally, inflation rose to really high levels. We saw inflation averaging over 10% last year. Now central banks have reacted. They've tightened monetary policy. They've lifted interest rates to levels where it hurts. We've seen growth slow down and we're seeing inflation coming off, which is great news because we import a lot of inflation from the rest of the world, and that imported inflation is easing. So half the job that we're trying to do locally is being done for us offshore. The other half, the domestic bit, well, that's the tough bit. That's the sticky inflation that's coming out of our housing market. It's coming out of construction. It's coming out of service industries, and it's going to be hard to contain.
Visit kiwibank.co.nz to stay up to date with detailed economic analysis and forecasts from Jared and other KiwiBank experts. They take big issues from both here and overseas and make them relevant to Kiwi businesses.
Are you making the most of your KiwiSaver investment? Generate is an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of strong long-term performance. Making a smart decision now could add tens of thousands of dollars by the time you reach retirement. Book a no-obligation chat with a Generate KiwiSaver advisor today at generatekiwisaver.co.nz/getadvice. A copy of the product disclosure statement is available at generatekiwisaver.co.nz. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited, and of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns.
And just going through the process of trying to work out the costs and benefits, because there'll be benefits to citizens which don't show up in the Crown accounts, you know, if you're taking a very mercantile view of it. And but it's interesting to me that, let's say, someone born in 2008 doesn't take up smoking and, in fact, is stopped from smoking by the law. They grow up to be healthy, they are living longer, they've got more pep in their step, they're able to work, earn income, pay GST, not go to hospital with, you know, emphysema or the need to, you know, amputate a foot or whatever it is. It seems to me from a government point of view, there's some positives. You are collecting income tax and GST from that person who's alive instead of dead and working instead of not working. You also are not having to pay to, you know, amputate their foot or look after them when they're in hospital for 10 days or whatever. What surprised me about the study, though, was how when you have these 500,000 health-adjusted life years added to the population, that the government's position was actually significantly worse, because I thought there would be more benefits from not having to pay for all the health system costs and also plenty of income from GST and income taxes. What I hadn't sort of understood was just how much money the government makes from excise taxes, but also, and this is the sort of sobering and slightly spooky thing, that in a purely financial sense, it's in your interest for someone to die before they start collecting the pension, because then you don't have to pay them the pension. So can you talk through those measurements on health costs, on excise revenues, and then the whole, you know, lucky for us, they're not collecting the pension problem?
The goal of government should be to really have healthy and happy citizens with good well-being and good economic well-being. So the prime goal of the government should be to really focus on what the ledger is doing for the citizens. And we show that that's a massive improvement in income. But yes, the government needs to build roads and fund schools and run the health system. So it does need revenue. And in this case, because tobacco tax is relatively large, they are hit with a shortfall. And they're also, in the longer term, although they're spending less on healthcare for tobacco-related diseases, because people are living longer, they are ending up paying more superannuation, for example. So there is this problem of the shortfall, but we argue that the government should be delighted that it's having more happy, healthy retirees, because that's what we want in a good society. We don't want people to die at age 65 and save on a super. You know, that would be crazy. So we are very concerned that the government's taken this focus on trying to maintain tobacco tax to do some of their goals, like fund tax cuts. That seems particularly unethical. It should be trying to phase out tobacco tax along with their tobacco epidemic, so that its citizens are happy and healthy and can live a good long retirement. If retirement costs are too expensive, then it could adjust you know, the age of retirement. And a lot of countries are doing this. And it's bizarre that New Zealand isn't, because life expectancy goes up 2 to 3 months every year, but we haven't adjusted that retirement age since for many decades. So we're way behind on that policy front. So the government shouldn't be doing these desperate things like being addicted to tobacco tax, as they seem to be, and not think of what is best for society as a whole. So, I mean, another way, from a more economic perspective, that extra income going to citizens from being healthier and not being addicted to tobacco is a real economic gain. Whereas with tobacco tax, that's a transfer payment, really, from citizens to government. And government can do those transfer payments in a range of ways. It could, you know, raise tax revenue from other sources. You know, it could increase carbon taxes or taxes on alcohol or sugary drinks or junk food, all those things. So it's got a lot of options to replace declining tobacco tax over time. And it really is extremely perverse that they're clinging to that revenue source because they haven't got the sort of imagination to think of the broader picture in this case.
Nick, you spend quite a bit of time thinking about the policy issues and particularly the long-term effects of public health interventions. And I'm curious about what I call the political economy drivers. Why is it that voters put a high value on things happening right now? In fact, they seem to put a higher value on things that they already have and the thought of it being taken away. They seem to have put a much higher value on something happening this year or next year than they do in 10 or 20 years, even though it's just as real and we can be blinking sure it's going to happen. Could you talk us through that whole, what I call a recency bias, or a almost like a sunk cost fallacy, where people are, and politicians, seem quite easily able to convince voters that the thing that matters is right now, and the things that happen in the future aren't important because they're in the future, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future. So what's your view on using this almost actuarial approach to making, you know, thinking about these public policy issues?
Yes, well, this is a tragedy of human psychology. We are very short-term in our thinking, but we do show signs of being able to think long-term. You know, we start to be concerned about the future of our children and the future of our grandchildren. So there are these aspects to our life where we plan in the long term. We take out house insurance. We set aside areas like national parks. We do some good long-term thinking. But unfortunately, the politicians do often play to that short-term focus, because their whole career has a very short-term focus, you know, especially with a three-year political term and having to spend half their political term in election mode, for example. So they as a career are particularly vulnerable to the short term. So it's really incumbent on voters to say, we're trying to think about the long term, about our children, about our grandchildren, and we want things like a smoke-free generation. We want to get rid of certain products that are completely hazardous. And we have, in some cases, we've got rid of importing asbestos, we've got rid of leaded petrol, we've banned chlorofluorocarbons that were damaging the ozone layer. We've been able to do some of these quite big long-term things in some cases. And setting aside national parks is another very long-term type activity. We do all sorts of things in our building sector to plan for earthquakes that may not happen in 100 years with very strong buildings and so on. So there are these areas where we do get the long-term thinking right. And we were hoping with the government they would get the long-term approach to tobacco control. And it was It was nearly a bipartisan deal. The National Party, when debating the smoke-free law, was supporting the denicotinisation process. So it was a pity that the New Zealand political system didn't really cement in that bipartisan picture, and we would have had the key component of the new law, which is actually removing the nicotine from tobacco to make it non-addictive. So because National hadn't really got that bipartisan agreement with Labour, and it meant that their policy was probably hijacked by the more ideological perspectives of ACT and New Zealand First, unfortunately.
Just finally, thinking about, you know, how we solve this tragedy of the short term and our current political system, which under MMP means that in some cases minority views have to be adopted by the majority to form a government. And in this case, the voters and polls have shown most of the National Party, New Zealand First and ACT voters are actually opposed to the new government's decisions to repeal this legislation. They see it as a pretty clear choice being made to retain excise revenues in order to pay for tax cuts. So how do we weave into our legislation or into our constitutional arrangements ways to stop the politicians and voters, to be frank, from doing themselves damage with this short-termism? And I'm thinking in particular of the Public Finance Act, which puts into law a rule that says politicians have to be prudent with their fiscal arrangements, which is effectively bound the hands, you could say in a good way, or a bad way, but they certainly bound the hands of politicians over 20, 30 years. How could you do something like that, essentially put in an overarching long-term rule into the laws, which say that that politicians have to take into account the long-term, not just economic, but human effects of the policies they pursue? And across a different variety of things. So it's not just money in, money out, but actually well-being. So how could we do that?
Well, we can, I think, learn from some countries that have adopted various sort of commissioners for the future type arrangements, where, like we have a parliamentary commissioner for the environment, we have a commissioner with a supporting team that really applies the lens of what is the impact on our children's generation and our grandchildren's generation, to take that really multi-decade perspective and to apply that to the legislation. But also just the idea of having a three-year term is problematic, and most other countries have 4 or 5 years, and that allows politicians to develop more of these long-term policies, I think, and get out of the crisis mode that they seem to be in the New Zealand situation. But just getting back to your point about MMP, actually, MMP did favour tobacco control in the sense that the legislation that we've had grew out of the success of the Maori Party in its coalition with National to get the smoke-free 2025 goal in place. So it was really credit to that small party leveraging its political capital in a very good cause. And so I think MMP does serve the country quite well in some ways, even though at the moment it may not be in the smoke-free domain.
Nick Wilson, Professor Nick Wilson from the University of Otago, a public health professor. Nick, thank you so much for being on When the Facts Change.
Thank you. A pleasure.
When the Facts Change was brought to you by the Spinoff Podcast Network, together with KiwiBank. Visit kiwibank.co.nz to find out how KiwiBank are making Kiwi better off.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at the Spinoff.
If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate. The Spinoff Podcast Network.